Isaiah chapter 43, verse 10. We'll be starting Isaiah 43, verse 10. The prophet writes, "You are my witnesses, declares the Lord, and my servant whom I have chosen, so that you may know and believe me and understand that I am he. Before me there was no God formed, and there will be none after me. I, even I, am the Lord, and there is no Savior besides me. It is I who have declared and saved and proclaimed, and there was no strange God among you. So you are my witnesses, declares the Lord, and I am God. Even from eternity I am he, and there is none who can deliver out of my hand. I act, and who can reverse it?" There was a Jewish rabbi who was walking along a dusty trail along the northern edge of the Sea of Galilee, and he was reciting and meditating and pondering this passage from Isaiah, among others, from the prophet. And he was doing so in an attempt to commit these words to his heart and to his mind. And as he concentrated intently on the scriptures, the sun went down below the horizon, and he found himself now on the trail in the dark. As he continued to travel on the trail, he came to a familiar fork, but this time, rather than bearing to the left that would have taken him back to home, he instead, for some reason this night, chose to go to the right. And after several minutes of walking on the trail, he found himself outside of a small Roman fort that housed a garrison of soldiers. And out of the darkness came a loud voice from up on the wall, "Who are you? Why are you here?" After several minutes, or moments, the rabbi was a bit startled, and he simply replied, "What?" And the soldier repeated the questions, this time even more loudly, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" And in response, the rabbi's voice came back more confident than before, and he replied with a question of his own, as rabbis are wont to do. "What do you get paid to ask me these questions?" Now it was the Roman soldier who was a bit taken back, and he paused for a few moments, and finally, with sarcasm in his voice, he answered, "3 denarii a week, Jew. Why?" And the rabbi replied, "I will pay you double if you will stand outside my house and ask me those same 2 questions every morning before I leave home." Who are you? What are you doing here? Do you know who you are? Not what you've accomplished, not your family tree, not the vocation that you have chosen to pursue, but who are we really, deep down? And what are we doing here? Not here in this building this morning, but what are we doing here at all? What is our purpose, our reason, our mission? Because when it comes to answering these 2 questions, there are 2 possibilities. One is to do what most folks do, and that is to conjecture and to speculate and to theorize and to guess, and yet to never get beyond their own humanity. The other possibility comes not from man, but from God, in the form of divine revelation. When it comes to identity and purpose, God has not left us in the dark. He does not leave us to simply speculate or to conjecture. And what God tells us is that all of us are part of a story. Not just a story of our own that we could easily break our lives down into various chapters in our lives, but God says that we are a part of something that is much bigger, that we have a role in something that is far more an encompassing story than just our own. In contrast, as our culture increasingly drifts closer and closer to just total atheism, people find themselves robbed of identity and purpose because they are told that they're just a random collection of molecules that have no reason or meaning for their existence at all. It was back in January of 2009 that the atheist Richard Dawkins and his writer of the book, The God Delusion, and the British humanist society. Now, raised a significant amount of money to purchase some advertising that would appear on public buses, on the side of public buses in the United Kingdom. And the sign that was to go on the buses, you may have trouble reading it from the back, but it says this: "There is probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life." And as you think about that little piece of advertising, there's three observations that come to my mind. First of all, isn't it interesting that they use the word probably? They don't know for sure. In fact, this statement tells us that they know that they don't know for sure. They're guessing, they're speculating, they're conjecturing, they're theorizing, and yet in all of their speculation, they believe that the odds are somewhere less than 50% that there is a God. But what if they're wrong? What if there is a God? A second observation that I want us to make from this is that, does their statement assume that all of those who believe in God are the miserable ones on the planet? That Christians are the ones who are not enjoying life. And yet studies show that just the opposite of that is true. That people of faith are usually less stressed, more content, happier in life. And a third observation is that if it is true that there is no God, that human existence emerged merely by chance, then there is no way to avoid the inevitable conclusion that we have no purpose and we have no real meaning. But the Bible declares something different, doesn't it? The Bible declares to us in a variety of ways that we are not the result of an accident, that chance is not our creator, fate is not humanity's father, that instead we exist by the skill and the will of the most accomplished craftsman in the universe. And the Bible tells us that God did more than just make us, but that He made us to be objects of His love and with specific purposes in mind. And that makes each and every one of us significant and valuable. When we understand and acknowledge that God is our maker, that He has a purpose for our lives, that we are not just made for time but for eternity, then our significance is enhanced, our values change, our priorities certainly ought to be reordered. Our ability to answer those two questions: who are you? What are you doing here? Is dependent upon us knowing and understanding the story that we are a part of. And turn, if you would, to the book of Exodus, chapter 19, because ancient Israel supplies us with a marvelous parallel to help us answer those questions in our day and for ourselves. That when we come to see who they were and we come to understand why they were there, we see their story, and it equips us to see more clearly who we are and why we are here, and thus to better grasp our own story. Now look, if you would, at Exodus chapter 19. Exodus chapter 19, beginning in verse 1. We find that in the third month, after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. When they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain. Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now then, if indeed you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel." Now, most of us are familiar with the story that leads up to this. That back in the opening chapters of the book of Genesis, God creates Adam and Eve, and He creates them in love and for fellowship with Him. And yet, after a period of time, that relationship is fractured by sin. And what we find following Genesis chapters 2 and 3 and 4 is that all of humanity follows in the same footsteps as that original pair. By the time we get to Genesis chapter 6, humanity has become so corrupt, so evil, that God deems it necessary to wipe the planet clean and to begin again, this time with the family of Noah. From among the descendants of Noah comes a man by the name of Abram. And God not only gives instruction to Abram, but he makes promises not only to Abram, but to his lineage in Genesis chapter 12 and verses 1 through 3. That it will be through Abram and his descendants that divine blessing to all of the nations of the earth will be realized. The story then goes that there's 400 years that pass. And during the passing of those four centuries, the descendants of Abraham grow into a multitude of people, but a multitude of people who are enslaved in Egypt. By way of 10 plagues and under the leadership of Moses, God delivers that group of people from her bondage. And it takes them 3 months to make the trip from where they were in Egypt to where they are here. In Exodus chapter 19 at Mount Sinai. They will remain encamped around Mount Sinai for almost a full year. We know some of the things that were talked about prior to their arrival at Mount Sinai. And most of it, you'll remember, is in the form of grumbling and complaining. And yet behind all of that grumbling, there is, could be found, an implied question. What are we doing here? The difficulties of the desert skew their perspective of what had transpired back in the land of Egypt. It was not what they expected. But they have also come to Mount Sinai with little idea of who they really are. To this point in time, they are simply an enslaved minority who has been used and abused by a powerful nation. But they leave the land of Egypt and they come to Mount Sinai now as the people of God. They have been chosen to play a vital role in bringing blessing to all nations. It's here, what we just read, that is the first official encounter between their God, their deliverer, and the people of Israel themselves. And he does three things in these six verses. First of all, he points them to the past. He wants them to look back and to think. He then directs their mind toward the future. He informs them of where all of this is eventually going. And then lastly, he wants them to consider what he wants them to be and what they need to be in the present. And so for our lesson this morning, let's delve into these three dimensions and let's start in verses 3 and 4 with the past grace of God's salvation. He says that Moses went up the mountain, the Lord called him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." These words aren't just spoken for Moses, but for all of Israel. Moses' presence on the mountain is not for an opportunity of a personal communion with him, but rather is for the purpose of Moses bringing God's message back down to the people. And the first message he wants to tell them is a simple one. Remember. He begins by pointing to himself and his own actions on their behalf. Verse 4 is, in essence, a summary of Exodus chapters 6 through 18. And as God discloses himself to his people, he wants them to think back to what God himself had done in destroying Egypt in order to bring them out there at Sinai to himself. Keep in mind, this is only 3 months after they've left Egypt. 90 days prior to this, this same group of people was being whipped and beaten. They were slaves who were being exploited, but more than that, they were also experiencing state-sponsored infanticide. Just 3 months earlier, this people was being savagely treated, and it was in their great misery, according to Exodus 2 and verses 23 through 25, that they cried out to God, 3 months earlier, now they saw what God did in response to their cry. That God rescued them. That God delivered them from that. And they experienced that deliverance firsthand. They were there when God devastated Egypt. They saw and experienced or witnessed some of the plagues. And he brings them out. He says, I bore you in a picturesque way. I bore you as though on eagle's wings. I have brought you here to myself as a liberated, redeemed people. You are welcomed into my presence. They're offered a covenant of promise, not because of their own efforts or merits, but because of what God did on their behalf. And because we've read ahead, we know what's coming, don't we, in Exodus chapter 20. It's the giving of the law, in particular the giving of the Ten Commandments. But whatever is coming ahead is based on what God has already done. And their obedience to the law, their living as the people of God, is founded on the grace of what He has already done for them in saving them in the past. Their obedience to the law, therefore, is not going to be some sterile sense of legalism. They're not just going to blindly adhere to a divine set of rules. Instead, their response of obedience is going to be a natural response to the glorious deliverance that God had provided to them. Whether we're talking about Israel camped at Mount Sinai or whether we're talking about Christians in the 21st century, everything that we do as the people of God must come as a result of our understanding and our appreciation of the grace that God has demonstrated to us in the past. Some erroneously believe that the Old Testament, well, the difference between the Old Testament and New Testament is in the Old Testament you had to be saved by keeping the law, but in the New Testament we're saved by grace. The reality is that regardless of the age that anyone has lived in, all sinful people are saved by the grace of God. Look at how he starts chapter 20. Look how he begins even before he gets to the Ten Commandments. Notice what he says, chapter 20, verses 1 and 2. Then God spoke all these words saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Even before he gets to the stipulations of the law, he reminds them again of what he had done for them in the past. Whatever God calls us to do in terms of purpose, it must always be set within the context of what God has graciously done for us in the past. That's what Paul in Romans chapter 5 in verse 6 and well as verse 8 points to, that while we were still helpless, Christ died for the ungodly. Verse 8, but God demonstrates his own love towards us that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. 1 John 4 verse 10, in this is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son to be the propitiation for our sins. Any response of love to God on our part must be a response to God's love for us. Demonstrated to us in what he accomplished for us and did for us in the past. Israel's memory of what God did for them was to motivate them to obey and to keep the covenant. That is, to guard the covenant with them. You'll notice that's exactly where he goes in verse 5. He says, going back to chapter 19, verse 5, now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my commandment. Notice where he moves then. In the middle of verse 5, we see this shift from the past tense to the future. Then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. His great act of deliverance has been performed, but now God informs them of their purpose moving forward. Where is all of this moving? Where is all of it heading to? Now, if you've ever had the experience of being on a mountaintop, many of you I'm sure have, then it won't take much imagination to get a hold of this illustration. Think about the view of God from his position in the story at the top of Mount Sinai. Now, I understand God is omnipresent. I understand that God dwells higher than a single mountain. But in this narrative, God is at the top of the mountain and the people of Israel are at the foot of it. And when you're at the foot of the mountain, your view, your perspective, your vision is extremely limited, isn't it? From Israel's vantage point, they are the only people who are around. From their vantage point, they're the only ones that God has rescued, the only ones that God has demonstrated a concern for. And God certainly acknowledges that. In fact, He refers to them in verse 5 as His special people with whom He has a covenant. In fact, that phrase, own possession, is a Hebrew word that means personal treasure. And it was sometimes used to describe royal property in the context of an absolute monarchy where the king was the theoretical owner of everything in his kingdom. And yet within that total ownership in the kingdom, a king might select certain things that would be particularly prized by him. Things that he considered to be his own in a unique way, a private accumulation of things that came as the result of his own personal choice. That's the word. While it was true that in Egypt God had implemented his personal choice of Israel to be the jewel of his crown, if you will, they were not to make the mistake of thinking that they were the only people on the earth, that there were other peoples that God cared for as well. And so down at the foot of the mountain, Israel might mistakenly believe that they're the only ones God is concerned about. But up when you're on top of the mountain, God is able to see all of the nations of the earth. And He says, all the earth belongs to me. And from the mountaintop, God can see all of that, what Israel down below can't. And therefore, they're not just to be separate from the world so they can belong to God in some private sort of sense. They belong to God to be used by Him. They have a unique purpose, a unique calling. And it is here at Mount Sinai that we see God's plan for world redemption really beginning in earnest. Because here in this text, we see the balance between one specific thing that's happening with a single nation of people, and it's transpiring at one place in Mount Sinai, and yet at the same time, there is this universal perspective that's going on. That God has rescued just one nation from slavery and bondage, but His purpose in the overall story with which we're familiar is that this one event is just one in a series of events in order to bring about the deliverance of every nation of people on the planet. Now look back at chapter 9, verse 16. It's this similar universal perspective, if you will, that God references in Exodus chapter 9 in verse 16, or Moses mentions it. Look what he says in Exodus chapter 9 and verse 16. He's speaking here to Pharaoh. And this is what's said. But indeed, for this reason, I have allowed you to remain, Pharaoh, in order to show you my power and in order to proclaim my name through all the earth. In other words, God's telling Pharaoh, look, what I'm doing with you is not just you and me interacting, that there's a much bigger picture that is involved here. My interaction with you has a purpose outside of just you and me. And we know that God fulfilled that promise, that some hundreds of years later, Rahab is going to be familiar with the story of the Exodus, isn't she, in Joshua chapter 2. Even later than Rahab, after the conquest of the land, what we've been reading in 1 Samuel chapters 4 and 5 and 6, the Philistines were even familiar with the Exodus and what God did to Pharaoh. There was something that was much larger that was transpiring in the land of Egypt. And so even though God is just interacting with one group of people at a specific place, Mount Sinai, His purpose for them, His agenda for them, is much larger than just this local context. These are people that He desires to use in order to bring blessing and deliverance and salvation to a host of other people outside of Israel. When you read through the Old Testament, typically the frame of the camera is filled with the nation of Israel. And there are times where the camera pans and we see different groups or nations. But the camera is focused on a chosen group of people who have a close relationship with God. They are His special focus. But God has a purpose. They are involved in something that involves all of the nations. But there's something that's much bigger that they are also a part of. And that something bigger is to use Israel to be a blessing to all of the nations of the earth. And here in Exodus chapter 19, it seems that they're not even aware of the great purpose that God has for them. Who are you? What are you doing here? We are the people that God has redeemed and delivered and saved. For Israel, it was the exodus from Egypt and all of the accompanying miracles of the plagues. For us, it is the cross of Jesus Christ. And God points us to the cross of Christ and tells us, you have seen what I have done. You have seen and you have experienced all that I did to bring you into a unique relationship with me. But understand that I did it for a reason, a purpose. And it's not just for you. It's for the sake of others. It's not that you and I have been chosen or saved so that we get to be the only ones who go to heaven. It's that we've been chosen and saved that we can be the means by which God is able to save others. That is, you and I, we have an eternal purpose. And friends, that's significant. That gives us meaning. That is not just us in this little story that we're in our own personal story, but that we're part of God's much bigger story. That we have a role in that. Go back to Exodus chapter 19. Notice, if you will, verse 6. Here we find the third element. And that is the present grace of God's people. That is, people who are living in God's world with God's purpose in mind. Verse 6. He says, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That's who Israel was. That's what they were doing here. This is who they were supposed to be. You'll notice, not just citizens of a kingdom, but a kingdom of priests. I find it interesting that even before the establishment of the priesthood in Israel, God speaks to the manner in which He intends to use the nation of Israel with respect to all the rest of the nations around them. And that is that He will use them as His priests, His middlemen. A priest was someone who stood between God and man. And from that place, they functioned in both directions. On the one hand, it was the priest's job to teach God's law to the people. That through the priest, God's character and His person and His will would be communicated and made known to the people. And of course, Israel's priests at times will fail miserably, and the prophets will indict them for that. But from the other direction, the priests are also charged with bringing the sacrifices of the people to God. And so if it was due to sin or some other uncleanness in your life, you were prohibited from coming into the presence of God and the assembly of His people. You would bring an animal to the priest. The priest would offer that as a sacrifice in keeping with the law as it prescribed. And for example, if it was a sin offering, you would confess your sin over the animal, the head of the animal. Its throat would be slit while you stood looking on. Its blood would then be poured out on the altar and offered on your behalf. And when the priest did that, in keeping with the law, he would declare that your sin had been atoned for. And now you were once again allowed to come back into God's presence in the fellowship with the assembly and in fellowship with Him. And as they come to Mount Sinai, in the very first interaction, official interaction between God and this nation of people, He commissions them to be a kingdom of priests. It's the only time this phrase is used in all of the Old Testament. And what God is saying to Israel is this, you as a nation as a whole, you will be for me what your priests are for you. But you will do it for all of the other nations. You will be the people through whom I will reveal myself to the world. And friends, that same role, look back over at 1 Peter chapter 2. That same role has been charged to us as well as His people in the world today. That we are to be the vehicle by which the knowledge of God is brought to others and others are brought to God. We stand as His representatives in the world. Look at 1 Peter 2 verse 9. Peter's referencing and quoting in some phrases here what we just read over in Exodus chapter 19. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called you out of darkness and into His marvelous light. That little phrase, so that, that's a word of purpose. Here's your purpose. But how would Israel accomplish that? By being a holy nation. If you go back and look at Exodus 19 and verse 6. Not only are they a kingdom of priests, but he says, he describes them as a holy nation. Israel is just one nation among many that make up all of the people of the earth. But as God's royal property, they are set apart. They are distinct from all of those other nations, but not separate in a sense of living in isolation. Go back to the book of Leviticus. Look at Leviticus chapter 18, if you will. They are commissioned as a nation to share God's person and God's truth, thus bringing nations to an understanding and a knowledge of God. But they are also charged with displaying the divine nature, with reflecting the likeness of their Savior, by which they will show God to the nations around them. Leviticus chapter 18, notice what the instruction that's given here. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, this is verse 1, verse 2 now, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not do what was done in the land of Egypt where you live, nor are you to do what is done in the land of Canaan where I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You are to perform my judgments and keep my statutes, to live in accordance with them. I am the Lord your God. So you shall keep my statutes and my judgments by which man may live if he does them. I am the Lord. He says, look, don't live like the place where you just came from. The Egyptians, they worship empire, they worship Pharaoh, they worship military might. But he says, don't live like the people in the land where I'm bringing you either. The Canaanites, they worship fertility and business and wealth and sensuality. And God says, I want you to be different. I want you to be different from the people that you left. And I want you to be different from the people where I'm sending you. And of course, tragically, Israel often failed miserably to live up to this very high calling. And in their disobedience to His will for them, rather than bringing glory to God, rather than displaying God before the nations, they brought reproach upon Him. They became an object of ridicule to the nations. That rather than living distinctively in order to draw other people to God, they rejected God and they chose to live just like everybody else around them. And as a result of that, the nations were less attracted to God than they had been before. Don't miss the point here. Israel's disobedience to the covenant requirements had implications that reached far beyond just their relationship with God. It didn't just affect them. It had significant ramifications in regard to the outworkings of God's redemptive plan for the whole world. It would be by their obedience to God's voice in verse 5 that they would be a different kind of people because they served a different kind of God. And if you're going to be the people of this kind of God, then we have to live in a unique way. And God says, if you will live in the way that I tell you, then and only then can you be something for me in this world. Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. Notice what Jesus says in regard to our mission, our calling. Matthew chapter 5, here in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount, verse 13 beginning. Matthew 5, verse 13, Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and he gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. It's not just our belief system that sets us apart. Our behavior does as well. And our behavior may not be the most significant thing, but it is the most visible thing, isn't it? It's the most tangible means by which we distinguish ourselves from those who have not been raised up with Christ to new life. What's required of us, it is because we are saved that we have a high moral standard of thought and action. That as we flesh that out, we show others how life is to really be lived as the people of God. Folks, that's what's in keeping with our high calling. Paul exhorts his readers in Ephesians 4 and verse 1 to live in a way that is worthy of their calling in Christ Jesus. And he calls us to that same task as well. Some of the clearest proof of God's existence is not some logical, scintillating, exegetical argument. It's not forceful rhetoric. It's a pure, humble, godly life that is lived, as Jeff prayed earlier, in the shadow of the cross, but also in the brilliance of Christ's resurrection. When atheists put a placard on a bus proclaiming that there's probably no God, it ought to bring a response on the part of some people. I don't think that can be true. I don't think that can be true because I know Mike, and I know Tim, and I know Paul, and I know Richard, I know Sherry, and they're Christians. And I know God is real because I see God in them. I see the living Lord in them, and that's proof of God's existence. Who are you? What are you doing here? Just like Israel, we have experienced the grace of God in the past, haven't we? We remember what God did for us. We remembered it here at the table this morning. We have experienced His grace in salvation. Like Israel, that we have been redeemed for a purpose outside of ourselves. And that we are charged with fulfilling that purpose to bring others so that they would come to know Him as well. That is not just our little story, but that we're part of a much bigger story. God's story. And therefore, just like Israel as well, we are called in the present to respond to God's grace and to live differently in every facet of our life as we represent Him in this world, that the world may know that there is a living God because they see Him alive in us, and that they would be drawn to worship and to serve Him. This morning, do you know who you are? Really who you are? Do you know what you're doing here? If you've never responded to the gospel of Jesus Christ, there's no better time than now. Because understand that without Jesus, from the world's vantage point, you're just a collection of molecules that randomly transpired at some point billions of years ago in the past. God says you're much more than that. What are you doing here? Well, if you're just a collection of random molecules, you can't answer that question. That purpose becomes a word that's used only by fools. But if you understand that God's your creator, that He made you, then you understand that He made you with purpose and meaning and significance and value. So valuable that He gave His only Son so that we could come into a relationship with Him. That's what He did for you in the past. Won't you respond right now in the present to the gospel of Jesus? Won't you come as together we stand and sing?